I don't think that anybody, a comedian or an actor of any kind, says to himself at any time, I think I'm going to develop a style. I don't think he would know how to do that. I think you just find it. Innately, there's something that you do that you find out works for you. Some comedians talk very fast. They go from one joke to another joke to another joke, maybe topical humor. Now, I discovered when I first started to talk on the stage that would not have been my style. My style was to talk on a subject and stay on the subject. We never did anything that we thought was going to last. We never framed anything. We never started anything that we said. For instance, I've never gone to my writers, and they never went to me and came to me and said, let's make you a stingy character. Let's make Love and Bloom your theme song. Let's have a feud between you and Fred Allen. See, if we'd have framed all of that ahead of time, it would have never worked out. It always started by an accident. By accident, we wrote a couple of stingy jokes, and then they got big laughs, so we each week or every third week, we would put in a few stingy jokes, and before I knew it, I was a stingy man.
At 7 p.m. Eastern Time over Mutual Broadcasting's flagship WOR, The Mysterious Traveler went on the air. Written and directed by Robert Arthur and David Kogan, The Mysterious Traveler debuted on Mutual, December 5th, 1943. Maurice Tarplin played the title role with a good-natured malevolence. The Traveler mostly narrated from an omniscient perch. He rode a phantom train by night. The opening signature was the distant wail of a locomotive whistle, fading in gradually until the rumble of the train could be heard. David Kogan and Robert Arthur had met in Greenwich Village, New York, partnering on Mutual's Dark Destiny. After it was canceled, they came up with the Mysterious Traveler concept and prepared three sample scripts. Norman Livingston bought it for WOR. As independent producers, they were paid a flat rate for the whole package. Any money they saved by using the same actor in multiple roles went into their own pockets, so they used the best character actors in New York. Kogan also directed the series. On Easter Sunday, episode 19, Beware of Tomorrow, aired just as a gloomy dusk descended upon New York.
The Mysterious Traveler.
This is the Mysterious Traveler, inviting you to join me on another journey into the realm of the strange and the terrifying. I hope you will enjoy the trip, that it will thrill you a little and chill you a little. So settle back, get a good grip on your nerve, and be comfortable, if you can.
It is midnight, and an old automobile is driving along a narrow road through the woods. At a point where a second road, even narrower, crosses the first, the car stops.
Here you are, young fella. This is the professor's place.
Is it? All I can see is woods.
It's up that road, about 50 yards. Look sharp, and you can see the light shining between them two trees.
Oh, yes, I see it now. Then I guess I get out here. Would you hand me my bag, Sheriff Ramsey?
Right. Here you are.
Thanks. And that's a dollar I owe you, right?
Yep. Thank you. You know the professor, do you?
Yes. I was Professor Clark's laboratory assistant back in college 10 years ago.
Oh.
Why?
I was thinking maybe you could drop a hint to him.
A hint? What kind of a hint?
Well, that there's been some talk in town of running him and that man of his, that Barton, fell out of the county.
Running Professor Clark? Oh, you're not serious.
Yep. Of course, it's just talk. So so far.
But what has anybody got against Professor Clark? There isn't a milder man in the world.
Well, maybe so, but folks has got wind of what happened at the state penitentiary over in Hillvale last year.
Sheriff, you're talking in riddles. What did happen?
The professor went over there when they hanged Richard, that hauled-up killer.
Uh-huh.
And the warden gave the professor the murderer's brain. That's what happened.
Well, what of it? Professor Clark is a great authority on nerve and brain tissues. Maybe he wanted it for research purposes.
Yeah, I'm not saying he didn't. I'm just telling you how folks are talking. They think he's keeping that brain in a big glass jar and making it grow.
Oh, that's perfectly ridiculous.
Well, they don't think so. They got the notion that brain is as big as a bull calf by now. And they're afraid someday it'll escape.
Sheriff, for a minute I was taking you seriously. A brain as big as a calf?
Oh, I'm not saying I ever believed it, but it'd be a good idea if the professor'd give folks a notion of what he's really doing in that laboratory of his, with that Barton fella to help him. Then maybe the talk would die down.
I understand. All right, Sheriff, I'll mention it to him.
Well, then I'll be getting on. Good night, young fella.
Good night, Sheriff.
Right up that road, about 50 yards. You can't miss it.
A few moments later, Dr. Richard Dale was knocking on the door of an old stone house, almost hidden among the trees. A frail, white-haired old man answered the door. An old man who could hardly speak in his joy as he gripped Richard Dale's hand. He led the way down a long hall to a great room where strange equipment took up almost every inch of space. Retorts and electric furnaces, generators, batteries, and great glass vats. Dr. Dale stared around him in intense curiosity as Professor Clark helped him off with his hat and coat.
There. Now, sit down, Dick, my boy. Sit down and let me get a good look at you. So, you got my letter? Yes, yes, of course you did, or you wouldn't be here.
Thanks, Professor. Yes, I got your letter. And it made me so curious I took the first train. You promised me a surprise. Well, is this it, this amazing laboratory?
No, my boy. I'll come to that in a moment after you've met Barton, my assistant.
Barton? I don't seem to know the name. Should I?
No, he's not famous yet. But he will be. He's been with me only a few months. I couldn't get along without him.
He certainly sounds interesting.
You'll like him, I'm sure you will. Barton?
Yes, Professor?
Dr. Dale has arrived. I want you to meet him.
Why, of course. How do you do, Dr. Dale? We've both of us been looking forward to your visit.
How do you do? Yes, the professor's letter made me so curious I couldn't stay away. I'm still wondering what the great surprise is he promised me.
You'll see, Dick, in just a minute.
My curiosity's at fever pitch.
Well, it's time to satisfy it. Barton, is Alpha making some coffee?
Yes, he started it when we heard the car.
Alpha? Who is he?
Our general man of all work.
Truly amazing fellow. Here he comes now.
Shall Alpha serve coffee?
Good heavens.
I said you'd be surprised, Dick.
He's not human. He's a machine. A robot.
Yes, my boy. An artificial man made from metal and synthetic brain tissue.
A machine man. But walking and talking.
He's not very pretty, but then the professor was mostly interested in making sure he'd work.
He must weigh a ton.
No, only about 300 pounds. You see, Alpha's mostly aluminum and other light alloys. Inside his aluminum plates are some new batteries I devised, together with miles of fine silver wire and a dozen electric motors. And to give you only the highlights.
It's a good thing you did keep this for a surprise. If you'd mentioned it in your letter, I don't think I would have believed you.
Shall Alpha serve coffee now?
Yes, Alpha. Put it on this table here and pour a cup for Dr. Dale.
Alpha, do so.
Still can't make myself believe it.
Alpha poured coffee.
Go on, Dick. Take it.
Huh? Oh, yes, of course. Al, thank you.
Alpha, this is Dr. Dale, our guest. Any orders he gives are to be obeyed.
Alpha understands.
He looks clumsy, but he poured the coffee as well as a man could.
Yes, my boy, Alpha has capabilities you'd never suspect to look at him. Here, I'll show you. Alpha.
Alpha hears.
The fireplace needs more wood. Put on that big log there.
Alpha, do it. Alpha has log.
Now, break it in half.
Alpha, break it.
Six. Log, and he's breaking it with his hand.
Alpha, put log on fire.
Good. We won't need you anymore tonight, Alpha.
You can go back to your room now.
Alpha is going.
Be sure to switch off your batteries. They're going to need recharging tomorrow.
Alpha understands.
That's the most incredible thing I ever saw.
You see, Dick, I tried to treat Alpha as if he were really a man. So I gave him a room of his own. Like any machine, he's completely inactive when his batteries have been switched off. But his brain continues to function. It's an artificial protoplasm that I spent 8 years creating. It's the only thing that makes him different from any other machine.
But it means Alpha can think. Think like a man.
A machine that can walk and talk and think.
Ah, but Alpha's not the only surprise I have for you, Dick.
He's not?
No, I have another one. Even more astonishing. Nah, but you'll have to wait until morning to learn about that. Because now it's time we were both in bed.
I suppose you're right. It's after one.
I know you must be tired. I'm getting old, so I'm going up to bed now, Dick. Barton will show you to your room.
Of course, Professor. I'll see you in the morning, then.
Yes. We'll have a long talk tomorrow. Good night.
Good night, Professor Clark.
Dr. Dale.
Yes, Barton?
Could we talk for a minute before I show you to your room?
Oh, yes, of course.
It occurs to me the professor forgot to tell you why he asked you here.
Oh, yes, that's true. And I've been so interested, I forgot to ask.
It was his hope that you'd stay indefinitely and help us carry forward the work we've been doing here.
Stay indefinitely? Well, I have my own work.
Say no yet. Now, just think, Dr. Dale. Alpha is stronger and more rugged than a man. He needs no rest, no food. Yet he can do the work of three men. He can plow, reap, run machinery. Think how much drudgery a million like him could lift from mankind's shoulders.
Yes, that's true.
And already Alpha is technically obsolete. Professor Clark has the blueprints for a new machine man, as superior to Alpha as an airplane is to a bicycle. We want you to help us build them.
Well, I'm certainly tempted. Perhaps I could arrange.
Ah, excellent. And now there's only one more thing I want to tell you.
Yes, what is it?
It's about Alpha. You must help me persuade the professor to dismantle him.
Dismantle him? Why?
He has become dangerous.
I don't understand.
Because he was the first successful machine man that the professor built. He is imperfect in many ways. He's not completely reliable. I'm afraid that someday he may escape from the house and so do some damage that would seriously upset our plans.
Yes, that could easily happen.
The local inhabitants are unfriendly enough as it is.
I know. Sheriff Ramsey was warning me about that tonight. All right, I'll speak to Professor Clark about it tomorrow.
Ah, good. Then I'll show you to your room now, if you wish.
Yes. I am sleepy.
If you'll just come this way.
His mind in a whirl of amazement, Dr. Dale retired and finally fell into an uneasy sleep. How long he had slept, he did not know. When abruptly he woke with a scream ringing in his ears.
Help! Dick! Help! Dick!
The cry came from downstairs. Dr. Dale leaped from his bed and raced down to the lower floor.
Dick! Help! Help me!
In the lower hall. found Barton hammering on the heavy door of the laboratory.
Professor Clark! Professor Clark, what's wrong?
Barton, what's up?
It's the professor. I heard him call for help.
Huh. Yes, so did I. It woke me up.
The door's locked. He must be in there, but there's no sound in there now.
Well, we've got to break the door down.
Yes. Put your shoulder beside mine.
Right. You ready?
Ready.
And shut. There! Professor Clark, where are you?
Professor Clark, he's not here.
Yes. Here he is, lying on the floor beside the window. He's been murdered.
It was Alpha. It must have been. No one else could have done it.
But where is Al?
The window. It's open. He went out that day.
We've got to go after him.
I'm afraid it's hopeless. At night, in these woods, we couldn't possibly find him.
No, you're right.
It'll be morning soon. Then I think he'll come back. He knows that he can only go a few more hours before his batteries must be recharged.
Then we can capture him and destroy him. But, Barton, why did he kill the man who created him?
The professor must have come down to the laboratory for some reason. Occasionally, when he couldn't sleep, he would do that. He may have decided to make some more tests of Alpha.
Yes, but that doesn't explain
during
why...
During the test, something must have occurred. When Alpha returns, we can find out.
Poor Professor Clark. Well, we'll have to notify the police.
There's only the sheriff. In any case, I think we should wait till morning and then report the professor's death as an accident.
An accident?
Yes. If the authorities learn the truth, our research may be stopped. And when Professor Clark has achieved so much, can we let it go for nothing?
No, of course not.
Dr. Dale, we must carry on his work for him.
Yes, that's what he would want.
Then you will help me continue it? You'll stay?
Yes. Yes, I'll stay.
Greatly upset by the tragedy, Dr. Dale returned to bed and at last fell into an uneasy sleep, haunted by dreams of Alpha, the metal monster Professor Clark had created. When he awoke, the sun was shining, and he could hear Barton moving about downstairs. He dressed and went down to find Barton getting breakfast ready.
Oh, good morning, Dr. Dale.
Good morning, Barton. Any sign of Alpha?
Not yet.
Well, we ought to start a search for him.
But first, I think you ought to eat breakfast. Everything's ready.
Oh, all right. Some coffee anyway.
Yes. Sit here.
Thank you. I didn't know you were a cook as well as a lab assistant, Barton.
I've learned to do a lot of things since I came here.
Aren't you going to eat, too?
I'm not hungry. I seldom am. But I thought that while you ate, I might outline some of the problems facing us.
That's a good idea.
You see, though Alpha's brain is of synthetic protoplasm, it is not completely artificial.
I was wondering about that. Sheriff Ramsey mentioned that the professor secured a human brain from...
From an executed killer, yes. The professor found that to give life to his artificial brain tissue, it was necessary to add a small amount of tissue from a real brain.
I see. The real tissue gave life to the rest. Of course.
Yes, but in this instance, it may have tainted Alpha's brain with a murderous impulse of a killer.
Yes, that sounds plausible.
So our first problem will be to obtain untainted brain tissues to blend with the artificial tissues we will make according to the professor's formula.
That should give us no trouble. I can get what we need through the research laboratories where I'm connected.
Ah, then that solves our worst problem. The rest will be matters of detail. Fortunately, there's enough equipment here to build a dozen or so robots.
Like Alpha, you mean?
No. The far more advanced type Professor Clark was perfecting. And now, if you've finished, I have something to show you.
Yes, I'm through. I don't feel much like eating after last night.
Then come with me to the laboratory, and I'll show you the second surprise that Professor Clark had in store for you.
All my writers have been very, very good. I don't remember not having a good writer, but by the same token, the same writers have been awfully nice to me because they figure not only am I easy to write for because of the characterizations, but that I'm a help to them because they think I may not be the greatest writer in the world, but they think I'm the greatest editor. And they think I know what to tell them. And I make as many mistakes as anybody else. Sometimes I'll tell them that I don't think this is right for the show, and it turns out great. And I apologize to them. I'd rather apologize and have a good show than have a lousy show and say I was right.
Opposite the Mysterious Traveler, the Jack Benny program signed on live, coast to coast at 7 p.m. from WEAF in New York, and at 4 p.m. from KFI in Los Angeles. By April 1944, Benny's writing team consisted of Sam Perrin, Milt Josephsberg, John Tackerberry, and this man, George Balzer.
We've taken our Those Were the Days microphone to Van Nuys, California, where we are visiting with George Balzer, who wrote for Jack Benny for 25 years. What was it like to write for Jack Benny for 25 years, George?
I've always regarded it as a privilege for having experienced the opportunity of writing for a man like Jack Benny.
When did you start with Jack?
1943.
You were one of four writers who came on board at that time, wasn't it?
That is correct. At that time, there was myself and my partner, Sam Perrin, Milt Josephsberg, and John Tackerberry. We followed a team of Bill Morrow and Ed Beloine, who had been with Jack for 5, 6, 7 years previous to that. And then they went their own direction, other directions, and we moved in as Jack's writers.
Was there a head writer in the group of Benny writers?
Yes and no. And the reason I say yes and no is because the head writer, the head writer was Jack himself. Even though he didn't actually do much writing, he was the one who really controlled what he wanted to do.
By the spring of 1944, General Foods had been sponsoring the program for 10 years, first with Jell-O, and then Grape Nuts Flakes. Benny's ratings had quietly been slipping since 1941. At the end of this season, his contract with General Foods was up.
How long were you on for Jell-O?
Oh, for a long time, General Foods, Jell-O, and then when they had enough of that, we went on. We stayed with them for Grape Nuts Flakes and Grape Nuts and all this and that. And
there was tension between the two parties, because Benny helped save Jell-O from going out of business.
Well, you had insisted on the comedy commercial right from the beginning.
Right from the very first show.
Well, you wrote most of those, didn't you?
With my writers, yeah, sure. We wrote every one of them. When we started for Jell-O, the Jell-O commercials saved Jell-O because Jell-O was going out of business almost on account of Knox Gelatin was beating the hell out of them. And so they wanted the comedy commercial, figuring that that could be the one thing that would save it.
Benny had full control of his show. NBC also guaranteed his Sunday time slot for as long as he wanted it. This position allowed Benny to sell his program to the highest bidder.
What happened was, the last year that I was with General Foods, so I had a few shows that weren't as hot. But I still had a lot of great shows.
So this was in the middle 40s? The so-called famous Jack Benny slump, that you moved from number one to number seven.
Or something like that, or something. Right? Or they thought, so they practically said to me, watch it a little bit, because some of the shows, as though every show had to be perfect, you know. See, I spoiled them. So the minute they said that, and then they went back to New York. Now, they didn't have an option. The thing was over. But they did want to give me a new contract. But the way they said to me, just watch a little bit. I got mad. So I said to my manager, I said, let's get another sponsor. I don't want to be with them. And we wired them on the train as they were going back that we will not be with them anymore. Because right away I had like 4 or 5 big offers from Lucky Strike, from everybody. And we grabbed Lucky Strike immediately.
George W. Hill, the president of American Tobacco, wanted Benny's show. His chief account executive was 36-year-old Pat Weaver, the future president of NBC. Benny's management team quietly held a sealed auction for sponsorship on February 24th. A surprise winner was announced. Ruthraff and Ryan, agency for American Tobacco's Pell Mell Cigarettes, bid $25,000 per week for 3 35-week seasons. The weekly money was payable to Benny for all payroll and production costs. They also included an additional $200,000 over 3 years for marketing and promotion. American Tobacco also agreed to pay for any network and carrier line charges. The advertising community was stunned. the Easter Sunday program was Pell-Mell's audition. In the end, this would be the only Jack Benny episode to have a Pell-Mell commercial.
Ring the bell for Pell-Mell!
Pell-Mell! Pell-Mell! Pell-Mell!
Pell-Mell, famous cigarettes, the cigarette of modern design, presents the Jack Benny program with Mary Livingston, Bill Harris, Rochester, and yours truly, Don Wilson. Ring the bell for Pell-Mell. Yes, friends, Pell-Mell rings the bell for you in smoothness, coolness, and better taste. Your eye tells why. Just make this test for yourself. The next time you see a Pell-Mell smoker try to light an old-fashioned short cigarette, watch what he does. You'll find that he holds the flame a good half inch beyond the tip of the short cigarette. Of course, he's looking for something that isn't there. He's looking for Pell-Mell's modern design. Modern design means Pell-Mell is longer. From the very first puff, Pell-Mell's greater length travels the smoke further, diminishes heat and bite on the way, filters the smoke naturally over a 20% longer route of Pell-Mell's traditionally fine tobaccos. Yes, friends, modern design means Pell-Mell is smoother, cooler, a better tasting smoke. That's modern design. Pell-Mell's modern design. And that's the answer. That's why Pell-Mell rings the bell.
Ladies and gentlemen, today is Easter Sunday. So let's turn back the clock one day and take you to Jack Benny's home in Beverly Hills, where we find Jack trying to decide on what clothes to wear in the Easter parade. Mary is helping him.
Oh, sweet Georgia Brown. Gosh, Mary, I don't know what to wear tomorrow. My gray suit is at the cleaners.
Well, what about the green suit you wore yesterday?
That's my gray suit. That's why it's at the cleaners. You know, it always turns green in the spring. You know. La, 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 la. Gee, Mary, I'm glad you dropped in. What shall I wear tomorrow?
Jack, Easter only comes once a year. Why don't you buy yourself a new suit?
Well.
You can afford it, you know.
Well.
For heaven's sake, Jack, it's not such a big decision.
I know, but with my luck, I'll buy a new suit today, and tomorrow I'll be drafted.
Well, now I've heard everything. You drafted?
Yes, me.
Jack, they stopped drafting beer, and that had a better body than you have.
Don't be so funny, Mary. I'm in pretty good condition.
Oh, yeah? Well, I got a surprise for you.
What?
I was doing some volunteer work at the local draft board, and I saw your file.
You did? What was my classification?
I didn't notice that, but yours is the only card there trimmed in black.
Mary.
All the other cards are written. Yours is engraved.
Mary.
And in the corner it says, keep off the grass.
Now cut that out. If you want to help me pick out a suit to wear, all right. If not, you can... There's someone at the door. Yes?
Pardon me, are you the owner of this house?
Yes, why?
You better fix that broken cement on your sidewalk.
What?
I was just walking by here with my wife, and she tripped and fell.
Oh, that's terrible.
Worse than that, it could have been me.
What?
It's a lucky thing I'm nimble.
Well, I hope your wife isn't hurt, and I'm sorry it happened.
Then you admit it happened.
Huh?
You're under oath, you know.
What?
I'm suing you.
Suing me?
For $25,000.
$25,000? Now, wait a minute. You can't sue me.
And why not?
You gotta have witnesses. How do I know your wife tripped and fell on my sidewalk? You gotta show me I'm from Missouri.
Well, take off that Wilkie button. I'm from Wisconsin.
I don't care where you're from and get out of here.
All right, don't get excited. You can't blame a guy for trying. All right, honey, you can get up now. We'll try the next street.
Are you a cheap chiseler? Go on, beat it. Imagine that guy coming here to sue me because of that hole in my sidewalk.
Well, that's what you get for neglecting things. That walk has been broken a long time.
I know it, Mary. I bought some cement a couple of months ago, but I never got around to fixing it.
Well, you better get it done before something really happens.
I guess you're right. Oh, Rochester! Rochester!
Just a minute, boss. I'm busy.
What are you doing?
Coloring some Easter eggs.
Oh, that's good. Did you boil them first?
No, boss. I fried them.
Fried them? Then what are you coloring them with?
Ketchup.
Rochester, stop eating those eggs and come in here. That guy eats everything. Doesn't he know that food is rationed?
He ought to. It's been rationed in this house for 12 years.
It has not.
What is it, boss?
Rochester, I want you to go out in front and cement that broken piece of sidewalk.
Cement?
Yes.
You mean a cement job?
Certainly.
Boss, when you hired me for your butler, I read the contract very carefully.
Well?
And the word cement, cemented, or cementing does not appear even in the small print.
What?
Or in section 3, clause 8, which is written in Egyptian hieroglyphics.
Oh, it doesn't, eh?
No.
Rochester, how many pages are there in our contract?
76, including the index, appendix, and list of illustrations.
All right, and what are those pages held together with?
You got me, boss. It's cement.
I know what I'm doing every minute. Now, Rochester, let's go out in the garage, grab the tools, and get started. Oh, boy, my arm. Breaking out these old pieces is hard work. Rochester, have you got the cement mixed yet?
Yes, sir. Doggone it, boss, you sure are perspiring.
Yeah, this is hard work.
I haven't seen you sweat like that since you were on Information Please.
Rochester, I was never a guest on Information Please.
Oh, that's right. I must have been thinking of Fred Allen. No, no, boss, forgive me. Forgive me. I didn't mean that. How could I have mentioned that name when you got a hammer in your hand?
You shouldn't mention it anyway. Remember, Article 7,
Section 19, Clause 8, page 12. And unfortunately held together with cement.
That's right.
Say, boss, I think you could make a straighter edge on that sidewalk if you used a chisel.
Yeah, I guess I could.
Hello, Mr. Benny.
Oh, hello, Dennis. Hand me that chisel, Rochester. Thanks.
How are you, Mr. Benny?
Fine, fine.
Have you read any good books lately?
No, no. Rochester, keep mixing that cement so it won't settle.
Okay, boss.
What are you doing?
What am I doing? What am I doing? What do you think I'm doing?
Planting a victory garden?
Look, Dennis, why in the world would I plant a victory garden on a cement sidewalk?
So you won't have to tear up your lawn.
Look, kid, there was a hole here and a lady tripped and fell in it, so I'm trying to fix it.
Oh.
Now, don't bother me. I'm busy.
Okay. Say, Mr. Benny.
Not now, Dennis.
Mr. Benny.
Dennis, please.
But, Mr. Benny.
For goodness sake, Dennis, what is it?
You've got the chisel on my foot.
Oh. Did I hurt you, kid?
No, it went between my toes.
Well, I'm glad it didn't hurt you. Now, Dennis, will you please do me a favor and go in the house and talk to Miss Livingston? We got to finish this job.
Okay, I'll go in and rehearse my song for tomorrow's broadcast.
Good, good. There, Rochester, the space is all cleared out now. Will you pour the cement in?
Okay.
Good. Now I'll smooth it over with the trowel. Boy, this is really work. Rochester, what's so funny?
Both of us playing in the mud here, we look like Topsy and Eva.
Yeah, we do at that.
Hey, Jack, Jack.
What is it, Mary?
Dennis is going to rehearse his song for tomorrow. Do you want to hear it?
Yeah, leave the window open.
Okay.
Now, Rochester, you smooth that corner over near you, and I'll level this part over here.
Pat Weaver and George W. Hill knew no one would take Ruthrath and Ryan's bid for Pell-Mell seriously. Had Foote, Cone, and Belding, American Tobacco's agency for its top cigarette, Lucky Strike, entered the fray, the attention would have driven up the price. The last Benny show sponsored by General Foods was June 4, 1944. Benny took out a full page in Variety, thanking General Foods for 10 years of service. In August, he left on a three-week USO tour of Australia and the South Pacific. Then on August 28th, American Tobacco announced that Pall Mall sales wouldn't justify a $25,000 per week expenditure. Instead, Lucky Strike would sponsor the show. The following week, they announced a comprehensive multimedia ad campaign. It was estimated to cost over $250,000. Lucky Strike would sponsor the Jack Benny program beginning October 1st, 1944.
Then, I don't know what happened with that. We were on for years and years and years. And then I went with Lucky Strike. I think Lucky Strike made me a bigger, better deal, whatever it was. So I went with Lucky Strike.
Rochester, how does the cement job look?
Boss, you're wonderful. That's the best thing I've ever seen.
Yes, sir. And they gave Paul Lucas the Academy Award. It'll look even better, Rochester, when I give it the finishing touches.
Say, here comes Mr. Harris and Mr. Wilson.
Where? Oh, hello, fellas.
Hello, Jack.
Hey, Jackson, what'd you lose? I didn't lose anything. I'm cementing the sidewalk.
Oh, well, it's about time. The other night I passed by here and stubbed my knee.
You mean they're getting the joke already? Phil, you stubbed your toe.
I stubbed my knee. I was coming home from a party.
Oh, well, why didn't you come in?
I couldn't. Alice had me on a leash.
That's very funny, Phil. Now stand back while I... Don, get away from my cement with that stick. What were you going to do?
I was only going to write, Donald loves grape nuts.
Don, I don't care how much you love grape nuts, you're not going to advertise your romance on my sidewalk. How would you like it if you had just cemented your sidewalk and I wrote in it, Jackie loves Gladys Zabisco?
Well, I wouldn't mind if she was malt rich, sweet as a nut, and had that whole grain nourishment.
Yes. I wouldn't mind if you didn't have a frog in your throat either. You know, Don, if you ask me, I think you're silly.
I think he's cute.
Huh? What?
You remember me? I'm Hyman Peabody, the insurance salesman.
Oh, yes, yes. You belong to the carpool with my gang. I didn't see you standing there behind Mr. Wilson.
I couldn't see you either.
Well, that I understand, Herman.
What you doing?
Oh, there was a hole here and a lady tripped, so... A lady tripped, so I'm fixing it.
Oh.
Now, Rochester...
You know, that's very dangerous, Mr. Benny. You could be sued for a thing like that.
Yes, Herman, I know.
We have a very liberal insurance policy that covers all that. only costs $10 a year, and if you trip and fall, you collect $1 million.
$1 million? Herman, you mean I'd collect $1 million if I tripped and fell?
That's right.
Gee.
Only you have to be hit by lightning at the same time.
Hit by lightning?
On Tuesday at 3:30.
What?
Bull of a watch time.
Oh, fine. Imagine putting in a provision that you have to be hit by lightning. I wouldn't take out that kind of a policy.
Oh, I don't blame you, Mr. Benny. You look silly wearing it in your hat.
Wearing what in my hat?
No chances.
Look, fellas, I gotta finish my job here. Why don't you go in the house and take Herman with you?
Okay.
You'll find Dennis and Mary inside.
See you later, Jackson.
Now, Rochester, just a little more smoothing out here and we're all through. Hand me that...
Here comes somebody, boss. I better take some of these tools off the sidewalk.
Yeah, I don't want anyone to trip on them.
Now, pardon me.
Boss, look up. Look up. It's Mr. Basil Rathbone.
Where? Oh, hello, Mr. Rathbone. Basil, it's me, Jack Benny. I'm doing a little cement job.
So I see. I didn't think you'd last long in radio.
I'm only cementing the sidewalk because it's an emergency. That's all.
That's right, Mr. Benny. Still on the radio.
Oh, some soap program?
No, food. Breakfast food.
I see. Well fed, but dirty.
Just a minute. Did you say I'm dirty?
That's what he said. That's what the man said. He said that.
Rochester, please. I guess, Mr. Rathbone, you just said that because right now my clothes are covered with cement. Thanks. I bet you're surprised that I'm capable of fixing a sidewalk like this.
Oh, no, not at all. I've seen you in pictures, and I realize you must be able to do something.
Well, look, Mr. Rathbone, I've followed your career for years, and if I remember correctly, you've never won an Academy Award.
Have you?
No, but nobody sees my pictures. What's your excuse? I guess that'll hold you for a while.
Oh, say, Mr. Battlebone, is somebody following you?
Where? Oh, no. That's my butler.
You mean you make your butler walk along the street with you?
Oh, yes, he doesn't mind. He's very democratic, aren't you, James?
If you say so, sir.
Well, I say so, James.
Thank you, sir.
Rochester, gather up the tools.
If you say so, sir.
Now cut that out and stop curtsying. Please.
Oh, Mr. Rathbone, sir, should I fill your pipe again?
Yes, James, please do.
There you are. May I give you a light now?
Yes, James.
There you are, sir.
My, this tobacco is strong. James, a cuff for me, will you?
Yes, sir.
What?
Once again, please.
You feel better now, sir?
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Rathbone, do you have your butler cough for you?
Yes, with my heavy schedule in pictures, I can't afford to strain my throat.
Oh, Rochester. Rochester.
I know, boss. I'm going to catch a cold so I can practice.
Good. I'll audition you later. It's not a bad idea.
Oh, James.
Yes, master.
I think we've dallied long enough with this dilly. Let's bounce along, shall we?
If you say so, sir.
Toodaloo.
How do you like a guy like that? Who does he think he is, anyway?
Oh, Jack.
Yes, Mary?
We're getting hungry. How about some sandwiches?
Okay. Rochester, you worked pretty hard out here.
Yes, boss.
Come on inside and make some sandwiches.
If you say so, sir.
Wait till the gang sees what a nice, smooth job I did with that cement. I'm really proud of it.
Have you gone to the house yet?
Yes, master. And if I may say so, you have a funny gleam in your eye. What's up, sir?
That wet cement on the sidewalk. I
can't resist it, James. For years, I've wanted my footprints in cement of Grauman's Chinese Theater, but I've never had the chance.
Oh, I've been ashamed of it too, sir.
But now, Jack Benny unknowingly has given me the opportunity to put my feet in cement.
Yes, sir.
Ah, just look at it. So fresh and nice and soft. Here, James, hold my shoes.
Yes, sir.
And wait a minute. Here are my socks.
Yes, sir. You'd better let me hold your arch supports, too.
Oh, yes. Yes, by all means. Ah, now to put my feet firmly in this wet cement.
Would you like me to test it first with my elbow?
James, I only want to stand in it, not sit in it.
I'm sorry, sir.
Now, the left foot first. And now the right. Oh, James. You haven't lived until you've had the thrill of having wet cement ooze up between your toes.
If you don't mind, sir, I'll stick to my blue jay. Are you enjoying yourself, sir?
You've no idea, James. It's wonderful. Now I shall remove my feet. Ah, just look at those beautiful footprints.
Come on outside, kids. I want you to see it.
Oh, Master, I think they're coming back. Let's run.
Yes, James, hurry.
I'll show you the best cement job you've ever seen. I'm really proud of it.
Oh, pull in your chest. It's almost out to your stomach.
Well, what if it is?
I don't blame you for being proud, Jack. You worked hard on it.
Well, there she is, kids. Take a good look. Yipe! What happened, Jackson? What happened? Look at the cement. Look, somebody put their footprints in it.
And look at the size of them.
Yeah.
I wonder where the other footprints are.
What other footprints?
Anything that has feet that big must have two more to go with them.
You're not kidding. I wonder who stuck their big feet in my cement.
I can't understand it. My mother's in Cleveland.
This is the dirtiest trick that has ever been played on me. Who could have done it? Why, there wasn't anybody around when... Hey, wait a minute.
What's the matter, Jack?
Basil Rathbone. Basil Rathbone was here just a few minutes ago.
Why would he do a thing like that?
Yeah, why would he do it?
That could be the reason.
I don't care what his reason is. I'm going over to Rathbone's house and punch him right in the nose.
I don't blame you, Jackson. I'm going to punch him in the nose, too.
After me.
Don't argue about it, fellas. He's got enough nose for all of us. Anyway, I'm not afraid of him. You guys wait here, and I'll handle this myself. They don't come too big for me.
Yes?
Tell Mr. Rathbone I want to see him. You remember me.
Oh, yes. Yes, you're the cement worker.
I'm Jack Benny, the movie star.
If you say so, sir.
Well, I say so, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Now, tell Mr. Rathbone I want to see him.
Yes, sir. Wait right here, please.
I'm not waiting for anything. I'm coming in right now.
Oh, Mr. Rathbone. Mr. Rathbone.
Yes, James?
Wipe off your feet, sir. Here he comes.
Oh, no, you don't, Rathbone. I've caught you red-handed, and you ought to be ashamed of yourself.
But, Jack...
Imagine a man of your position in the community doing a thing like that.
But, Jack...
Sticking your big feet in my cement. What have you got to say for yourself?
Jack, I know it'll be difficult for you to understand, but it's a phobia with me. When I see cement, something happens to me. Something comes over me. Something seems to snap inside me.
Basil?
I can't control myself, Jack. Please believe me. I fight against it. But it has me in its vicious, unrelenting power, and no matter what I try to do, it overwhelms me.
Basil, control yourself. It isn't that serious.
Yes, it is. You're only being kind to me.
But, Basil, if it bothers you that much, you can come back and help me fix the cement.
Oh, Jack, I will. I will. Oh, this is so kind of you, so generous of you. I don't deserve it.
Basil.
I don't deserve anything. I'm a cad. I'm a scoundrel.
Basil.
I should be horsewhipped.
Basil.
Oh, why? Why did I do it?
Basil, calm yourself. Just come over and help me fix it.
For heaven's sake, Jack, will you wait till I finish my scene?
You've seen? You mean you're just acting now?
Certainly. You're not the only one who hates Paul Lucas.
Michael, you too?
Yes, pal. Well, what do you know? Come here, chum. I want to talk to you. Imagine giving Lucas the Academy Award for one scene where he left his home and said farewell to Betty Davis.
Oh, brother.
You said it.
Particular people congregate, you see the smart red Pall Mall package. Day after day, the demand for this smart, distinctive, better-tasting cigarette is growing. Yes, it's easy to tell the swings to Pall Mall. And no wonder. The moment you take a Pall Mall out of the package, you see why Pall Mall means a smoother, cooler, better-tasting smoke. Instantly, you see Pall Mall's greater length. That's modern design. Now, light up a Pall Mall and see what happens. Pall Mall's modern design travels the smoke further, filters it naturally over a 20% longer route of Pall Mall's traditionally fine tobaccos. Heat and bite are diminished. Yes, modern design is a difference you can see. Modern design means a difference you can taste. Modern design means Pall Mall is longer. Modern design means Pall Mall smokes cooler. That's why Pall Mall rings the bell for you in smoothness, coolness, and better taste. So swing into line with modern design. The next time you buy cigarettes, ask for Pall Mall in the smart red package. Ring the bell for Pall Mall.
Pall Mall. Pall Mall. Pall Mall.
Ah, good night, everybody.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.